This is Fresh Air. I'm Dave Davies in for Terry Gross. Peter Sarsgaard stars in the new film Garden State from writer, director, and actor Zach Braff, who plays Andrew Largeman in the film. Sarsgaard plays Mark, a high school friend of Andrew's who's never left town or had any big ambitions. When Andrew returns home for his mother's funeral, he finds Mark is still getting high and pulling scams for cash. In this scene, they're in a houseware store. Mark has picked up a box of knives and walks over to the returns department.
Why are you buying knives? I don't need knives.
I'd like to return these.
You got a receipt?
Actually, no, they're a gift.
Why are you returning these?
They're not sharp enough?
They're not sharp enough?
No, not for what we need them for. They couldn't cut cans.
You bought them to cut cans?
No, but in the commercial it said if I wanted to cut cans, I could.
Well, it comes with a sharpener. Did you try it?
Yeah. They're just... I don't want them. Okay. They're not sharp enough.
Okay.
Sarsgaard got his start in Dead Man Walking, and he co-starred in K-19 and Shattered Glass. His breakthrough performance was in Boys Don't Cry, based on the true story of Tina Brandon, a young woman with a sexual identity crisis who moved to a new town, dressed as a boy, fell in love with another woman, and was killed by the woman's ex-boyfriend. Sarsgaard played that boyfriend, Jack Lauder. Here's a scene in which Lauder and his ex-girlfriend Lana are at a birthday party for Tina Brandon, who's now using the name Brandon Tina. John's not only jealous, he suspects that Brandon isn't what he says he is. As they watch Lana dance, John sits down next to Brandon and puts his arm around him in a half-friendly, half-menacing way.
She's beautiful, isn't she? Oh, man. I know, since she was like this high. I could tell you stories about her. You know, kind of stories. She told me about you guys. And I can't think of a better guy to give Lana to than you, so happy birthday!
Thanks, Joe.
You know, there's just one thing you gotta remember, little man, is this is my house.
Come on, turn up the music!
Later in the film, John Lauder rapes and murders Brandon Tina. When Terry spoke to Sarsgaard last year, she asked him about portraying such an unlikable character.
I remember reading a story about John Lauder before we started. It was about he was being taken to a reform school by his mother, and he was going along the highway. And you know, I don't know how fast they're going, but he really, really did not want to go to reform school, and he was very, very close with his mother, and he was very upset. And he jumped out of the car as the car was moving, because he wanted to be with his mother so badly. And that, I think that was a very significant story to me when I heard about it. And that's not so much playing someone as, because his life is so different than mine, something like that sort of allows me to love him, you know, which is what you have to do with those characters.
Well, empathy is so important when you're acting, but when you're... I imagine it's hard to find empathy for somebody who's not a good person.
Yeah, yeah. I mean, you know, your director really helps you in that situation, because they, on that movie, Kim Pierce, the director, made me feel like, she made me feel like a stud and the sheriff of the town, that I was a kind of law enforcement.
Mm-hmm.
You know, albeit my law, which was a... had some kindness to it. Like, I did not want to mete out the punishment. It was not something that I felt like I was being forced to do it, which is, you know, a kind of psychology that Kim just worked over on me, you know, and a good director will do that. They'll just start seeing the world through your eyes with you, you know, like over your shoulder, going, look at this new guy who came into town and is now your girlfriend, ex-girlfriend, is all over him. This is the woman who is the only person that wrote letters to John Lauder when he was in jail. And, you know, really his only connection to the real loving world that we all know. And so, you know, at first my bad feelings toward Brandon Tina in that movie have nothing to do with the fact that it's a woman dressed as a man, or, you know, it really has to do with the fact that a very small man that looks like I could beat up is taking my ex-girlfriend from me.
I know some people who didn't see Boys Don't Cry because they didn't think they could sit through what they knew was coming, which was that she, you know, that Brandon Tina Brandon gets beaten, gets raped, gets killed. Can you talk about what it was like to do those difficult scenes?
Yeah, I mean, it can be very technical some of the time. I mean, you're obviously, my main concern doing those scenes is that I don't hurt the other person. And so frequently, you know, I've been on both sides of violent scenes in movies, and I always prefer to be on the receiving end because you don't have to worry, you know. The main problem in doing them is that you want it to look real. You want it to, because the fake version of that, I think, is kind of socially irresponsible. But so you want it to have a sense of reality, but you also don't want to hurt your co-star. So that's mainly what's going through my mind a lot of the time. And because of that, it's hard to indulge all of the animal instinct stuff that comes up in you while you're doing it, you know. You need to have people there that know what they're doing and give you all the equipment you need. I mean, in terms of doing a rape scene, you have to figure out logistically what you're doing, you know. I mean, it's the kind of stuff nobody talks about, but it's like you have to take down your pants, because people do when they do it, and that will not look real for the movie. And presumably she wouldn't have hers on, but then we don't want, you know, it's uncomfortable. And so you, in that movie, we actually put a dam in at one point to try to, you know, just to have something literally from me to hit when I was raping her. So it's incredibly, I mean, when I'm talking about it in that way that's so detailed, you can understand how it's not just doing a rape scene. It's like a whole logistical thing with people's feelings and people's bodies and trying to take care of everyone.
Did you find yourself apologizing to Hilary Swank because you had to treat her rough in the scenes?
I didn't, no. I didn't, because it seemed like the amount that it was upsetting her was not an amount that was going to affect her life, you know, like how, you know, her daily life as she went out, mm-hmm. but that it might be good in the scene. And, you know, after we finished the movie, she and I, you know, patted each other on the back, and I congratulated her on her Academy Award and everything and felt so good about it. And we're friends now. But while we were doing it, if I had apologized each time after I did a take or something, I mean, it's, then I'm not John Lauder, and she's, you know, it makes her job harder, I think.
Your first film role, I think this was your first role, was in Dead Man Walking.
Yeah.
What was your part in the role? Your part in the film, I should say.
I was the boy who was raped and murdered. The reason Sean Penn goes to death row, he rapes and murders my girlfriend and I. So, yeah, that was another rape scene. I'd been on the receiving end, say, from that movie.
Well, did that help, having been on the receiving end in a movie?
Absolutely. How? Absolutely. Well, because I knew doing Boys Don't Cry and doing the rape scenes and everything that, you know, Hillary, who's the victim in that scene, wants as an actor for that all of this effort that you're going through, and it's physical and it's emotional and it's all these different things, that if you're only going to do it halfway, it's really almost as hard as doing it the whole way. And that you really might as well go all out, you know, because we don't need to see sort of how it happens in movies. Isn't it going to be more effective and more informative in our lives if we see closer to how it might really happen? And, you know, Sean Penn always errs on the side of it might really happen, you know. So, and Sean very much took care of me and Missy Yeager, who played the girl in that scene. I mean, the next day, everyone got us massages and everything. And I mean, it was that scene was very elaborate also because we got thrown down in the mud and then raped and murdered. But obviously, to do another take, we had to go take showers, get dried off, put on makeup and our clothes, and go do it again from being dry and not muddy, because we were filming in the bayou in Louisiana. So, you know, that scene went on all night, you know.
So did being, like, really tired as the night wore on help in looking like a scared and under attack young man?
Yeah, I mean, I think it helped actually wear me down. I think takes probably 1 through 4 were unusable because I'd never been in a movie before. So I actually, the energy that I had from just having a camera pointed at me and acting with Sean Penn and doing all of this, it was probably too much, you know. So by the 8th take, I'm sure it was just
they had to beat
more
you
reasonable.
Down first.
Right. It was more reasonable. It was like the Stanley Kubrick style. Beat the actor down until they just will do it.
You were an English and history major at Washington University. What had you planned on doing when you were in college?
I wanted to be a writer, actually. One of the reasons I went to Washington University was because Stanley Elkin, a very great short story writer and novelist, was teaching there. And I, you know, was just a huge fan. And so I got to meet Stanley, and I actually performed his short story, Poetics for Bullies, which is in the Criers, Kibitzers, and Criers collection. And then it turned out William H. Gass was teaching there, who's also an incredible thinker and novelist. And Howard Nemiroff was there at the time. And I just became sort of like, I don't know that I learned anything from any one of these guys except just to be around people that were just so fully committed to something so specific. You know, that Stanley's writing is so specific, and he did it his entire life.
Well, Stanley Elkin had MS, and toward the end of his life, he was, you know, very, very, very sick and had lost a lot of physical functioning. What was it like to be around somebody who was both your mentor but was very, disabled at the same time?
Well, you know, he's in a wheelchair. I mean, you never know with Stanley Elkin, because, I mean, he's just, he sort of made humor out of bile, you know? I mean, which is like, a lemonade out of lemons. I mean, I remember one of his stories is about a guy in a wheelchair who has to go to the bathroom, and his wife leaves him right as he has to go to the bathroom, and he has to figure out how to go to the John. And that's how the story starts. So Stanley always had, like, a great deal of humor about his circumstances, I think, and just a keen, keen wit, and that's something that no disease could kill in you.
Why did you abandon the idea of writing?
A combination of I wasn't sure I was very good at it, and also it's not, sitting alone writing is not in my personality, you know. I very much need someone to say action and cut. I need people to make me do what I do for a living. I have a whole team of people that send me scripts and make sure I read them and ask me questions about them, and then you work with a director who you want to serve, and I work better when there's a group that I can disappoint. You know, if I were writing, the only person I could disappoint would be myself, and I'm too willing to do that.
Oh, you'd have an editor you could disappoint.
Oh, okay, great.
So, led you to acting?
Well, at first, a little bit randomly, I just started doing plays in college, and then this program that's at the New School, the Actor Studio program, had kind of a satellite program. I think it was before they even started it at the New School. And Shelley Winters and Ellen Burstyn came down and, you know, taught for a bit, and Carlton Collier and all these people that are studio people came down, and they wanted non-actors, you know, people who are not in the theater department, because you know, I think there's a little bit in the actor studio, there's a little bit of this idea that the best actors are going to be the ones who didn't want to be actors or something. You know, there's some sort of, it's a romanticization of what it means to be an actor. You know, we found this guy kind of thing. And so I was drawn to it just because I wanted to meet famous people. And I, you know, this class in particular. And I was very influenced by the ideas because it's sort of a somewhat intellectual way into acting, you know. I liked the idea behind it.
Now you said you got into acting in part because you wanted to meet famous people. Now that you've met and worked with a lot of famous people, is meeting famous people still of any interest?
Meeting people that are... It's I would say not meeting famous people, but meeting people that I respect is always interesting, you know, that I've respected from afar. That said, it's very difficult to act with somebody that you respect in that way.
Why?
Because there's a distancing thing that happens. I mean, for example, if you're supposed to, if your lover in the film is an actor that, like, I've watched in movies since, you know, say the early 90s or something like that after I got out of college, and I have to be intimate with them, they're still going to be kind of in my head from these other movies. And so there's a process that takes usually, I think, a very brief period of time depending on how willing they are to drop it. It's really up to that person to let go of the... It's empowering to have that kind of respect. And it's up to them to let go of that power in order to act with you.
Who has that happened with?
I've been fortunate. It's happened with a number. You know, with Liam Neeson, it happened with me. Actually, Liam plays, and I play a kind of. We are basically lovers in Kinsey. I mean, his wife is also my lover in the movie, so it's a little bit confusing. But you know, grew up watching Liam Neeson in movies, and he's got this incredible power and charisma as an actor, and it's difficult to imagine that person being your lover if you've seen them in movies for all that length of time. So, but Liam is exactly the kind of guy that lets go of that kind of power the moment you meet him, or, you know, tries to. And then it's up to the two of you to negotiate some new relationship, you know.
Did Sean Penn let go of that power when he was killing you in Dead Man Walking, or did he keep that power so as to better be forceful with you?
Yeah, he kept it. I mean, I think there was no reason for him to let go of it.
Mm-hmm.
Yeah, and it absolutely depends on the role. I mean, some of the time it can work to your advantage. Harrison Ford in K-19 never let go of it with me, and it's because he played my commanding officer. And he was the Daddy Warbucks that I had to go talk to when everything was going wrong. And it was much better if he kind of kept that enormous presence that he has. And, all I could do was react to it. So many of the circumstances in that movie were true to life. I'd never been on a nuclear submarine before. My character had never been on a nuclear submarine before and was asked to be the guy who took care of the heart of the machine, the reactor officer, you know. I'd never been on a $100 million movie before. I'd never acted with, you know, Harrison Ford in this situation. And I was entrusted with a very significant part of the story, you know, the heart of the movie in some ways. And it was incredibly intimidating, and every day was very stressful for me on that movie. But I think it looks right in the film. So.
Mm-hmm, mm-hmm. Well, Peter Sarsgaard, thank you so much for talking with us.
Thanks a lot.
Peter Sarsgaard speaking with Terry Gross last year. Sarsgaard's now starring in Garden State.